Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Our fathers fought Franco. James Maley, Jaws Waters, Donald Renton, and Archibald Williams were members of Machine Gun Company No. 2 of the 15th International Brigade. This is the first book to focus on a small group of men from different starting points, ending up in the same battleground at Jarama and then in the same prisons after capture by Franco's. It's a fascinating book, and I'm delighted that the author or the editor of the book, Willie Maley, joins me live on the line from Glasgow. Good morning to you, Willie.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Normally, when we talk about the Spanish Civil War, which is, to put it mildly, one of the most complicated conflicts of the 20th century, we look at the grand sweep of things, the strategies, you know, who the major players were, the anarchists, the communists, the nationalists, etc. This takes a different tact.
Yeah, it takes a very different tact. And now, there's been books before that have been biographies of individual international brigaders or memoirs by those individuals, and there have been oral histories looking at a group of brigaders who were involved in different engagements at different periods of the war, but there's never been a book about four men who end up in the same place, in the same company, in the same battle, in the same prison, that traces their lives from birth to death. So you've got really four working class lives, four biographies of these men, following them from their birth, their entry into activism in the 1920s and 1930s, going to Spain, being captured together, imprisoned together, and then their afterlives of activism or disaffection or disillusionment, it follows them right through to the end of their life. So there's never been anything like quite like this before. It's a collective biography of international brigaders who went at the same time and ended up in the same place. So I think that's what makes it unique, and also the prison experience and the fact that one of the international brigaders, A.C. Williams, kept a diary, a tiny, small, miniature book, notebook, in which he had a record of their daily lives, their activities, playing baseball, you know, and he's got the signatures of all the men, including my father in that. So as I say, that's that artifact and that story, I think, is absolutely unique.
And it was a struggle. The international brigades made up of men and women from all over the world, and it was an idealistic struggle. I mean, it was absolutely, we're going to go and fight fascism wherever it is. There was huge, obviously, there were huge street battles all over Europe between, you know, Bolsheviks, communists, and fascists, and this was seen as by many young men and women from all social classes as something that needed to be done.
Absolutely, and it was seen by them as a way of stopping fascism in its tracks, and some of those that went from Germany, for example, German Jewish volunteers, were people who felt they'd lost the battle in Germany and needed to fight it on another front. So absolutely, it was seen as a prelude, it became a rehearsal. At that time, they thought they could do something to stop fascism. Interestingly, someone just gave me a gift yesterday from a second-hand bookshop, and that gift was a book about the Luftwaffe in Spain from 1936 to 1939. So yes, this was preparation. Germany was preparing for the war, and Spain was a testing ground, and we know that from Guernica, for example.
Yeah, the infamous Condor Legion, etc.
Absolutely, but also for the tanks, that the German tanks that were being used in Spain and so on. So I think from that point of view, it was absolutely, you know, of global importance what was happening in Spain. And as I say, a lot of the people that went, like my father and Jordy Waters and AC Williams and Don Renton, believed that you could take fascism on in Spain and stop it in its tracks. And you might say, yeah, that was idealistic, because that's not where fascism was stopped, but that's what they believed they could do, that this democratically elected government was under attack.
So tell me a little bit about your father, and we look at sort of a small group of men. Did they know each other before then, or did they meet on the battlefields or in Spain? How did it all come about?
Two of them, Don Renton and Jordy Waters, knew each other. They were very active in anti-fascist activity and around Edinburgh in the 1930s, and were involved in hunger marches and so on, which my father was also on. AC Williams had spent some time in Canada. My father had spent some time in the States. So two of them, Don Renton and Jordy Waters, knew each other. Of course, they then travelled together in various buses through England and into France and across the Pyrenees in December 1936. 6 weeks later, they were thrown into what was the most costly, bloodiest and notable battle in Spain at Jarama. And they were captured together, and some of their comrades were shot in front of them, and they themselves thought they were goners. And it was really because they were identified as British that they survived. And then they were taken to various prison points, including Talavera de la Reina, and then eventually ended up in Salamanca, at which point they were released at the end of May.
Let's get back a little bit, because, I mean, a lot of us will know, obviously, the international brigades were there, but you said they travelled on buses, so presumably they were recruiting, they could go to somewhere in Scotland, in Glasgow or Edinburgh, and come down. I mean, how did it actually, I mean, because we tend to think of people sort of picking up a rifle and a suitcase and heading south and crossing the Pyrenees, but it seems to be more structured than that, because a lot of us won't be aware of how they actually recruited or how they actually got there.
Yeah. So there's two things, I suppose. There's the fact that these men were very educated and informed about what was happening in Spain from about 1931 or 32 on, because they took an interest. My father knew about what was happening in various parts of Spain in the early 1930s because he read the International Socialist Press and read the Daily Worker. So people like my father did know. They were very engaged, if you like, in a socialist media with what was happening in the world. And it was the Communist Party that were organised in Scotland and in Britain, the volunteers for the international brigades when they were called for. So my father had actually joined the Territorial Army in 1934, and he was a good shot. He knew how to fire a rifle, but he left his rifle. He didn't take his rifle in his suitcase. He just took a bag and went down to George Square in Glasgow, where there were three double decker buses full to the brim, you know, and it was four or five men from the house next to the street that he lived in, and they all kind of knew each other then. They would know each other at that stage from the Communist Party, whatever branch they were in. So that's how it happened. These three buses that were packed with men, standing room only, went down to London and then on to Paris and then on to Spain, to Albacete, where they did the training, and then straight into the lorries and off the back of the lorries and straight into the midst of a bloody battle. And he was part of a machine gun company. So although he was a crack shot with a rifle, as he later proved in the Second World War, he was operating Maxim machine guns, these water-cooled, quite antique machine guns. That was what they were. That's what he was firing. That's what he was working with. So he didn't have his rifle with him.
Did any of the men sort of note down their first impressions when they, because you said they were literally given a couple of weeks training in Albacete and then thrown into the battle, literally. So very little training. Ideological is one thing, but, you know, when you get into the heat of conflicts, it's entirely another. Presumably your father, having been a territorial, knew a little bit about how to look after himself, but a lot of them would have been absolutely bewildered and shocked about what was happening.
They were very mixed. I mean, I suppose what held them together was their beliefs. They were a mix. There were people who had been First World War veterans. There were people who had experience of fighting, who had been in the army, and people like my father. So it was a very, very mixed group. But they weren't fantastically well equipped. And as I say, they were in the midst of a kind of battle, which even the soldiers in the First World War haven't been involved in. And I've read the testimony of men who fought in Spain and then fought in the Second World War, and they said there was nothing like Spain because it was a particularly brutal, particularly up-close form of battle. I mean, you know, kind of street-to-street kind of a battle. So these, I have heard men who served later, my father served in Burma and India later, say that there was something particularly brutal about the events in Spain, and probably just the suddenness, the fact that they jumped out the back of these lorries and straight into this, and they lost half the battalion in that first day's battle at Jarama. So my father just saw men falling down dead all around him who had never fired a shot, you know. So I think for that point of view, it was very costly. But on the other hand, it was seen as quite a heroic, you know, stoppage. It did hold back Franco's forces at that point. So that's Jarama was seen as a kind of a significant moment, although it was in a moment in a war that was ultimately lost, and it was a very costly battle. But it was effective. The men who went were effective.
And he was captured. And as you said, he was because he was British and because of the international brigades, that may have, because you mentioned it was, the Spanish Civil War is brutal. It's barbaric. You could touch on what happened to the civilians as well. But your father and his comrades then were But you could say they were particularly lucky that they were sort of British when they were captured by the nationalist forces.
Yeah, I think that once somebody spoke, they'd already shot one of the officers, actually an Australian, Ted Dickinson. He'd been identified as an officer, and they just shot him through the head in front of the rest of them. Then somebody said something in English, and they said, "Oh, English," and they stopped. But Spain was unique because it was the last cavalry charge and the first mass civilian bombing, Guernica, and my father's company were actually surrounded by Moorish cavalry and on horseback and led along with their thumbs tied with wire to their captivity. So it was that, it was like opposite end. You had something which seemed to be come from the past and something which augured the terrible future of war. But yeah, that was what they were basically surrounded. They ran out of ammunition, the machine gun company, and then they were surrounded and captured. And you know,
and what was the prison experience like for them? Because obviously, you know, they're in the middle of a civil war. The front line keeps changing, left, right, and centre all the time. The ebbs and flows. I mean, where were they sent to, and what were conditions like?
I think it's interesting you say civil war, and some people would say it was a revolution, and others would say it was a war caused by Spain's loss of its North African colonies. Other people would say it was an international war. It involved Italy and Germany. So it was this. But you're absolutely right to say it was a deeply divisive war, civil war too. That's also a fact. I've kind of forgotten your question now. You'll have to repeat it.
I was saying what, you know, because obviously lots of Republicans fled across to France over the Pyrenees, and then were then interned in French camps. But what was the situation like, you know, for your father and his comrades who had been interned in a Franco, you know, in a nationalist prison? Because something tells me that they weren't exactly the most hospitable conditions.
That's a great question, Giles. And what my father always said was for the Spanish who were in there, i.e. the Republicans, for the Germans, life is terrible. The Germans were interrogated by the Gestapo. The Spanish were killed. So a lot of the prisoners were executed, and the ones that were executed were the Germans and the Spanish, maybe for obvious reasons. Although my father saw a lot of comrades killed, including some of those that were killed after they were captured, he and his men were part of a prison detail. They went out, I think, to bury bodies. He didn't say that, but there was a van that would come, a wagon would come to the prison and take away those who were to be executed. And on one occasion, there was a story that it was the men from this machine gun company that my father was in who were going to be executed. and they were ready to, as it were, make a break for it or to see what they could do to save themselves. But in the end, the van passed by and it wasn't for them. And they and then got exchanged, supposedly for Italian Black Arrows captured at Guadalajara in the march. But I think it was an intervention by the British embassy, because although Britain was disgracefully neutral and effectively, you know, complicit with Franco at the time for all kinds of reasons, maybe Gibraltar came into play at some point. But although they weren't involved, and I think behind the scenes, it wasn't good for them to have this number, and it was raised, this number of British prisoners being held by Franco. So they were released at the end of May, the men in that company. So yeah, their nationality, their status probably went in their favour. Otherwise, when they were captured, they just assumed they were going to be shot one by one. That's what had happened. They saw that happen to others.
And this micro diary, I mean, incredibly brave, incredibly dangerous, because obviously if he'd been caught with that, I mean, you'd imagine that he would have been shot out of hand.
Yeah, if you were caught doing anything, you could be shot out of hand. I mean, my father went to the latrine one day to the toilet, and he was inadvertently whistling a Republican song and got punched in the face by one of the soldiers. So you were constantly under scrutiny. You were in very cramped conditions. There was lice. There was rats. They were cold. The food was awful. They were half starved and so on. So they were in these terrible conditions. But as I say, at the same time, my father felt like that they were more fortunate than my father spoke to these two young Spanish guys who he seemed to think were maybe 16 or 17 years old. And their chances of getting out alive were very, very thin indeed, you know. So from that point of view, my father was a bit older. My father was 28. He turned 29. He had his birthday in the 19th of February, 1937. He turned 29 in prison. But he was a bit older than my father. And, he left school at 14. He's worked outdoors a lot. He'd emigrated to America. He was a very hardy character and a bit older. In that war, there were young guys when they were 17, 16, 17, 18. There were people that lied their way over in terms of their age, because they were 15 or even 14. So for that point of view, my father always seemed to be, he was the kind of old head on old shoulders for the and yet there were people, men also in their 40s who had fought in the First World War. So it was, as I say, it was a very a varied group of men.
So you edited this book. So how did you compile the information? And because it's not only the diaries, but also there are newspaper reports, newsreels, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, because many years ago I had the idea for a book, The Scots Who Fought Franco, and it would have been a bigger book. It would have lots of voices in it and lots of men and so on. And it was going to be, because I realised the last of the actual international brigaders were fading away, were dying off, and I thought it would be good if we could get the children, and maybe in some cases the grandchildren, to tell those stories. So that was the idea. Then the book just narrowed itself down, because I happened to meet Tam Waters, Lisa Croft, who's the granddaughter of A.C. Williams, and also Jenny Renton, who's the daughter of Don Renton. I met them and I thought, there is a book here. There's a book here about these four men who were in the same place at the same time, at the same moment, and looking at their lives. And of course, at that point, Lisa, the daughter of Rosemary Williams, A.C. Williams' daughter, was born while A.C. Williams was in prison. So A.C. Williams went to Spain with his wife, heavily pregnant. His daughter was born while, and she was called Rosemary for remembrance. His other daughter was called Jennifer Talavera, because of Talavera de la Reina. So you had these remarkable stories started to come out, especially, as I say, the story of A.C. Williams and the diary. And then Lisa showed me this remarkable little pocket-sized book that was kept in secret in the prison and secreted about his person, which is very difficult. And I just thought that was a remarkable story. But I must admit that Tam Waters and Lisa Croft did me a tremendous service, because they went off and they wrote their parts. So it was going to be a collective biography in four parts. They wrote their parts and they went from birth to death. And I hadn't imagined, first of all, I didn't imagine there had enough material or evidence about my father to write something that was, you know, with a quarter of a book. But they went away and did that. And when I saw how they did it, it was a brilliant lesson for me, because although the idea of the book was mine and I was the editor, I then looked, and as you know yourself, Giles, in the digital age, we've got more access to information than any of our parents ever had or grandparents. Now, my father never saw the newsreels from which the images were cut while he was in prison, the Pathé newsreel. My father never saw photographs of the prisoner release. My father never saw a lot of material that we've now got access to. So new information, new evidence, new photographs, newsreels, new material, new scholarship, new research, all this came in. And when I looked at it, I thought, wait a minute, there is enough here for a quarter of a, you know, book. And in the end, we had these four brilliantly, I think, researched and narrated stories of these very different men. I mean, they're not four peas in a pod. One of the things my father always said was people argued like crazy in the prison. I mean, it wasn't a quiet prison because people came from different backgrounds, from different perspectives, and you know, you had people with different versions of what they thought they were fighting for. Even one occasion, my father was talking to a man in the prison, and the man said, "We were lied to because we came here because we thought we were going to win. We were on the winning side." And my father said, "Well, why were we here then if we thought we were on the winning side?" So the men argued all the time. It was like a political seminar or workshop, if you like, every single day in the prison. They argued and they sang and they fought and, you know, they disagreed. But I think just so that the idea of focusing on these four men who were in the same place at the same time, got there by different means because we follow their trajectories from birth to 36, 37. And then their service in the Second World War, and then right up to their, you know, in some cases, disaffection with what was happening with Stalinism and communism and the Cold War and all kinds of changes that people went through. Some people moving from the Communist Party into the Labour Party. And it's a very common, I mean, you could even trace this globally and say it wasn't just in Britain or Scotland. It was all over the world that these 35 or 40,000 volunteers, a lot of them first-generation immigrants, many of them from quite impoverished backgrounds and so on, that there was first of all, I mean, through the experience of having lost a struggle that they were in, but then you might say the bigger war was won later, but they had different views. And one of the things you'll know is that there's an element of nostalgia that you find in the British left about Spanish Civil War being its finest moment, if you like, its kind of celebrated moment of people actually putting their lives in the line for activism. On the other hand, as you also pointed out, anarchism, socialism, communism, sectarianism, sentimentality, all kinds of conflicting views of what happened and why it happened and so on, have over the years kind of ossified and made it more difficult for people to take a single view. And one of the great things about the book is that the family members who are recalling their father's experiences, we're not all reading from the same, you know, hymn book or whatever. So we've got very different perspectives on our fathers. Another thing is that two of the contributors of the four are women. Jenny Renton, writing about her father, and she was an only child, she was a daughter. And a father-daughter relationship is very different in terms of the kind of politics that you hand on, and even including there's a very masculine, patriarchal kind of left activism which excludes women. So there's that, and then there's Lisa Croft, who's writing. Her mother's in her 80s now. Her mother's as old as her ama. She always remembers how old her mother is, but the fact that she was born in March 1937. So her mother's. So she's writing on behalf of her mother, but you've got two of the four authors in the book are women, and I think that brings something completely new to the table, because this is primarily about men and men of a particular kind. I mean, and you mentioned earlier about the fact that a lot of them were untrained and inexperienced soldiers, but quite often, well, there's one account by an experienced soldier of the Spanish Civil War, and he says these working class men who had nothing to lose, that they felt were fighting for a cause, fought more determinedly than anyone he had ever seen who was a trained soldier. And he himself was a trained soldier. So I think there is that fact that they fought with a fearless passion and, you know, and would break into song and really be quite suicidal, as it turned out in some cases. But they were fearless, because to go there in the first place, to make this journey on a bus, knowing that you would never come back. And people did this who didn't. I mean, many of them didn't come back. I've spoken to several men whose fathers died in Spain. One of them was four when his father died in Spain. Another one was 12 when his father died in Spain. His mother came in and said, "You're the man of the house now." So a lot of these men didn't come back. And the amazing thing is, my father wasn't married. My father was a single man. But you know, that's not the case with the other fathers. A.C. Williams, you know, was about to become a father for the first time, and he was away to Spain. Other people had families too. My father didn't have kids at the time.
Yeah, it was interesting because they are making that ideological stand. It's something that has, you know, Spain is the battlefield against Nazism, against fascism. I mean, you mentioned your father was in Burma as well. I mean, he went back, I mean, because it was, again, it was different war, same opponents, if you like, or same ideology, although obviously it's slightly different. Yeah. And presumably he never came back to Spain, did he? Or
he went back in 19... I mean, my father fought in the Second World War, and I think a lot of the communists that had fought in Spain weren't allowed to serve in the British Army until Russia went in 1941, until Operation Barbarossa. And at that point, my father went out to India and Burma. And it's only later that somebody who's a historian of Spanish Civil War said to me, they sent a lot of the communists to the Far East, hoping that they wouldn't see them again, and keeping them out of the European theatre of war, because anti-communism was the big... anti-communism was shared by Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler. They were equally vehement in their Russophobia, or fear of the Soviet Union, fear of opposition to communism. So a lot of these international brigaders ended up in the Far East. You know, my father never travelled again, actually, after that. He went back to Spain in 1996 with my brother, and he revisited Jarama, and he met people and spoke to them and so on. But that was his only time out of the country after coming back from India and Burma in 1945, 46. He stayed on a bit. So I think it was 50 years, basically, before he was out the country again, and that was that one trip back to Jarama. And I've got a lovely photograph of my father at Jarama, you know, talking through what his experience was. I should say one other thing. The Imperial War Museum, God bless them, did an interview with my father in 1991, and I got the transcript of that. My wife helped me transcribe it, and my father speaks very quickly, 10,000 words an hour. So we got that interview, and it was loads of material. So that's really the material, and then someone else did an interview. So those two interviews, and my father, when he did those interviews, was 83 and 96 respectively, but he had all his wits about him. He had a brilliant memory. So although it's not a contemporary account, my father really did have a kind of photographic memory. He remembers details. One of the things he mentions, which made his interviewer laugh, was he mentioned that one of the Spanish captains in the prison had green hair. Green hair. Now, why would you make up a detail like that? So my father remembered all kinds of little things, little details, and so on, and things like, you know, the fact that they didn't have toilet rolls, so the conditions in the prison were not hygienic, and they were served from a collective tureen or a pot of soup, and this man dropped his bread in and rolled his sleeve up and put his hand into the pot from which the rest of them then had to eat. So there was a lot of problems with a lot of stomach problems, as you can imagine, because they weren't allowed to really clean themselves, and they spent a lot of time trying to de-louse and kind of a, you know, survive, and it was a kind of bare survival they were doing in prison.
What do you hope that people will learn, will take, will discover from your book, or from the book, as you've edited it?
I think the fact that history is still an open book, that's what certainly taught me, is that the Spanish Civil War was a family story for me as a son of an international brigader. But then you begin to look into the history and you realise there are all these different views and strands and perspectives. Paul Preston's written about this in Spanish Holocaust. He's written about the kind of colonial background and so on. So I think the fact is we're still finding things out all the time. And I think working class lives, we've got certain stories like George Orwell's that have been told, you know, brilliantly and eloquently and so on. But I think there's still a lot more to be said about what happened in Spain. There's more perspectives to be viewed. There's more evidence and more material appearing all the time, not just the recovery of bodies, but the recovery of memories and detail about what happens. In the last week, I got from the National Library a Museum of Historical Record in Salamanca, but I got it via Madrid. I got an 11-page document from the prison in Salamanca in 1937, which has my father's name in it, I mean, the document itself is just an account of the transfer from Talavera de la Reina to Salamanca. But it's a document, but I've never seen this document in my entire life before. And I got it for €1.10 from Madrid just in the last week. We've got remarkable photographs that we weren't able to use in the book because we couldn't get copyright clearance in time. Stunning photographs of the prisoner release from Bidasoa and Hondarribia and so on, crossing over from Spain into France, where there was all these people giving the fascist salute as the prisoners, including my father, walked through. Remarkable, stunning photographs that are clearly from a newsreel, but what we've got is these stills. As I say, we couldn't get clearance in time to use them in the book, but that's an example of just, you know, even after the book, there's so much more that can be said because there's so much more evidence, material, information, you know, and stories that emerge. So the one thing I would say the takeaway point from the book is there's an ongoing struggle against fascism, first of all, that never went away. You know, Franco never went away. A lot of the issues that are there never went away, and that includes issues like Catalonia and so on.
We're going to crash the news, Willie. We could talk about this all morning. The book is called Our Fathers Fought Franco. Is there a website? Where can people find you?
People can find me at willymaley.scott. And if they just go to Lewis, they can get the book.
Super. WillieBailey.Scott. Brilliant. And the book is called Our Fathers Fought Franco. Willie, I could have spoken to you about this for the next hour and a half, but I've got to go because the news is coming up next. Thank you.
I'll see you when you come to Glasgow.
I'll see you when I go to Glasgow. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay. It's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.